Did you want to go and start?
I should do an intro on this one.
Okay.
For the recording?
Yeah, I'm recording, but I'm
good afternoon, everybody. It's June 27th, 2019. It is 1:06 p.m. I'm Commissioner Brian Crotchis, joined by Commissioner Randy Christman, and soon to join us, Commissioner Julie Fedorchak. This is an update from MISO, as it's titled. So, Brian, it's all yours. Thanks for being here.
Very good. Thank you.
I'm wondering, I don't have any opening comments.
And Randy has no opening comments for the record. And I know Julie has no opening comments.
All right. Well, thank you. My name is Brian Tullo, Executive Director of External Affairs for MISO in the Egan office. We've been here several times before. Let me start by introducing my colleagues. We've got some new faces this time, and we've also got a very, I think, a different ask of us for this update than maybe what we saw this morning. We're going to have a much more topical focused updates. We've got a lot. We've got more people, but we've got a lot fewer pages to go through. With the idea that we can go a little bit deeper on some of these topics and have time for questions and things like that. You know Allison Archer, my colleague. She does regulatory external affairs for us. But the new folks in the room, as I just walked down the row here, first Tony Hunsinger. Tony is our manager of policy planning. And he went to Iowa State, so it's pretty close to the Dakotas, but not quite, right? He's an electrical engineer.
I think we've played you in football in the last few years, right?
Just checking.
Oh, we like you.
And then Jesse Mosier, who is our Director of Economic and Policy Planning. Jesse is actually lives in Austin, Texas, although he went to school at South Dakota State as an electrical engineer. So another bit of a Dakota tie, I think he's going to move back up this direction here pretty soon. But he was down in Austin working on his law degree because this wasn't complicated enough business to be in. So he's been going to law school part-time for the last few years down in Austin, Texas. So we're happy to have him up here today. And then Mike McMullen, some of you may have met. Mike has been around MISO for a while. Mike is our Senior Director of Regional Operations. So in short, Mike runs the control room that we have in Egan in the Twin Cities, which is one of our three control centers for the MISO grid overall. Our agenda today, as you can see on the page that's up on the screen, is three topics, and the first two are what we were mainly asked to focus on here. So our time allocation and our page allocation is going to be much more heavily weighted to the top, and then it gets smaller and smaller. By the time we get down to the very last topic, we'll have one page, and Allison will do that. But at the start, very simple, right? At the start here, we're going to have Jesse and Tony do the long-term transmission planning discussion, and then Mike will do the operational events and some of the lessons learned. We heard some of the a reference to some of the emergency events that SPP has had. You know, we've had our share too. So we'll hear more of and I think we heard this morning a market monitor's view of those events. And now we'll get to talk to the guys that are, or a guy that's in the operating room when those things are happening, and some of the lessons learned about how we keep the lights on when we get into those situations. I'll give a update on resource availability and need, which I'll explain more when we get there. And then again, Allison will finish with a DER update. So with that, I'll just turn it over to Jesse, and we'll dive in.
Okay. Well, good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity today. We can go ahead and scroll down to the next slide. So, you know, my presentation will focus on our long-term transmission planning activities. The nature of the deck is set up to provide a kind of general overview, but as we go through it, we hope to unpack some of the emerging issues and things that we're looking at today. As Brian mentioned, you know, we'd like this to be a discussion, so please jump in as we move along. You know, one thing that's been happening and will continue to happen, we heard some this morning to this effect, that the resource mix in this part of the country is changing and changing rapidly. And that's driving, putting a lot of pressure on the transmission system, and is really going to drive a lot of our activities for the foreseeable future. You know, historically, this is a generalization, but, you know, historically, transmission planning was based on a, you know, capacity at a peak hour, reliability-based upgrades. We think going forward, it's going to look more on the energy side and looking at all of those hours during the day and the issues that may arise with the different resource types, their different operating characteristics, how to maximize those characteristics to the benefit of consumers. So there's a lot of work to do there. We'll get into a lot of that as we go through these slides. The other thing I would say on the front end, you know, to address these issues, our goal is to look farther out into the future and look at a broader set of scenarios. That is part of our normal process. We've spent the past few years, I would say, more of kind of a annual churn, relatively near term in time horizon. We think now is the time that we need to take a step back, push that time out farther into the future, and try and address more of these emerging issues.
So, you know, you used very relative terms. You said looking farther out in the future, and that before it was relatively near term. So
sure.
Tell me, how far out do you try to look, or what do you think is appropriate, and what have you been doing till now?
Yeah, so what I mean by near term is kind of 5 years out into the future. That's where our focus has been for the past few years. And in our mind, farther out is looking 10, 15 plus years into the future and looking at how the system is changing, what could come. Are we planning in a way to manage different potential scenarios? And we'll get into a little bit on sort of part of our approach to doing that. But getting out past that five-year mark where our generation interconnection queues tend to drop off, and looking at what could happen from a resource mix beyond that time.
Is even 10 or 15 years sufficient when we're dealing with a lot of 30-year assets?
That's a good point. You know, it's an issue that we struggle with a bit. You know, I think, you know, one argument is just that these are very long-term assets. You're making a business case for something that's going to be there 40, 50 years. And there's this balance between projections that far out in the future. How do you quantify those values that are more uncertain because they're farther out compared to the cost that is a more tangible near-term value? So there's always that push-pull on how far out can you look before you lose sort of your basis in reality. So let's go to the next slide. So we're going to start, you know, really at the top. There's kind of three pillars to our overall MISO corporate strategy. Serve and grow our membership. Operate reliably and efficiently. And then where my focus will be today is envisioning the grid of the future and our long-term transmission planning activities. Next slide. Yeah.
So what does grow the membership mean?
What does grow the membership?
Yeah. Do you want to grow out and take over SPP's territory or PJM's, or what's your growth plan?
So I can't speak to a particular growth plan. Do you want to take that, Brian?
Yeah, I would put the emphasis on the serve first. I mean, the main thing we are there for is to help serve them and help them grow.
One thing that's always perplexed me is And we dealt with it at SPP and
yeah.
some similar type comments without ever much clarity about, well, you know, you got to keep growing when we're talking about the Mountain West situation a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And I always find myself wondering how many people in the RTOs or potentially at FERC imagine this just becoming a one big federal government transmission network. And so when, yeah. when you say serve and grow, I'm trying to figure out how you grow without
yeah.
doing that.
I think the grow is a reference to, you know, within any RTO, there are a lot of fixed costs. So one thing that becomes better for our members, if we've got a broader base to advertise over those fixed costs, we don't imagine consolidating the entire Eastern Interconnect into one RTO, even if that might make economic sense. I think the reality of how things have grown up and where things are, you know, that's not going to change. But there are several organizations within the U.S. that are adjacent to an RTO but aren't in the RTO, particularly in the southeastern United States, in that part of our footprint. So the idea that some of those utilities that aren't in an RTO might come into an RTO is certainly out there.
Okay. Would you be targeting corporate entities as well? Would you consider that as growing membership?
You mean as far as end users?
Mm-hmm. Like retail Amazon, customers. Yeah. Walmart, et cetera?
No, we're not reaching out to end users like that to come join us. We do have a sector of our membership. It tends to be large collections of industrial customers and things like that, like mm-hmm. Texas and Louisiana, that join as an association as opposed to individual companies. The names we heard mentioned this morning, you know, all those companies are market participants. So they can participate in the MISO market and, frankly, participate in our stakeholder process without being members. So they wouldn't necessarily join to be membership. They can still participate in the market. We've got 190 members. We've got 460 market participants, entities that are market participants. So most of those folks would just join as market participant, dive into the stakeholder process if they've got a particular topic that's coming up that they're interested in.
Okay. You know, so building on that high-level element of our overall strategy on the grid of the future, our board of directors and stakeholders over time have developed a set of guiding principles for our planning process. You know, what I would highlight about these principles is, you know, you see in the first three kind of the big hitters of planning: reliability, economics, and public policy. In addition to that, we do try to have an emphasis in supporting state and federal regulatory initiatives. We try to work that into our planning process. There are times when commissions will come to us and ask questions, and we will support those efforts through our planning tools and resources that we have at our availability. In addition to that, we do have a focus on SEEMS planning. So we've got the two RTO SEEMS with SPP and PJM. We also have a non-RTO SEEM to our south and east. We've got joint operating agreements and planning coordination provisions and how we work with them to identify SEEMS issues and SEEMS transmission projects. The recent development, we received an additional set of principles from the Organization of MISO States around planning principles, and as I read them, they really build upon and add another layer of detail for us to support our planning initiatives, sharing sort of that OMS perspective on what should be included in a long-range transmission plan. And so we're still kind of digesting those, but we certainly appreciate the effort that the OMS went through to develop that, and we'll be working on a response and next steps over the next several weeks. Okay. So the MISO planning process, we call our value-based planning. So it takes into account, you may have heard us refer to it as top-down and bottom-up. So we'll take into account local planning criteria, nearer-term reliability-based planning. We take into account policy, both state and federal, and also look at the resource planning, what's in our queues, and bring all of that together into our overall planning process. A phrase I think I might have mentioned at the top, but I'll go ahead and mention it again that you'll hear more frequently is this phrase, all hours matter. We're looking at how to improve our energy-based planning efforts, looking at those off-peak issues as well as on-peak and the value of transmission over time. You know, everything we do in planning we view as a collaboration between MISO and stakeholders. We've got several committees that help support these functions. I'll highlight a couple. One is that branch that you see coming off our planning advisory committee. So that's our kind of highest level planning group. It has dedicated stakeholder sector representation, but all stakeholders are welcome to and do participate in those discussions. Then as you kind of dive underneath that policy level committee, you'll get into some of our more detailed planning committees. We've got a planning subcommittee that kind of looks at the how we do things. We've got an interconnection committee that looks at issues with the queue. And then we've got these sub-regional planning meetings where they have a geographic focus to spend time, in the different parts of the MISO territory to focus on those projects in those geographic regions so you can get more of that local feedback on the projects. So that's kind of the planning branch on our stakeholder groups. We also have another committee called our RECB working group. So RECB stands for Regional Expansion Criteria and Benefits. What it is our cost allocation group. So that group's been active since 2005 or 2006, before I got involved with it. But it's been an active committee for most of the last 10 years. There's peaks and valleys when there's big initiatives. There will be a lot of activity there. Sometimes there's goes on hiatus. We did this year file some changes to our market efficiency, so our economic project category. FERC actually sent that back to us with some feedback. So right now we're in the process of internalizing that feedback and working with our owners on what next steps will be. Chances are we'll go back with something else after considering their feedback. Any questions on that? Okay. All right. Humming right along. So when we approach our economic planning processes, and this would also apply when we talked about pushing that time horizon out into the future, we would follow the same general process outline. We've been doing this since around 2005. And if you wanted to kind of break it down a little bit, the first two steps have to do with the model building and scenario building on the front end. And Tony, in a moment, is going to talk in a little bit more detail on kind of what goes into that process. The next four steps are really our analysis phase, looking at what the issues are, collecting proposed solution ideas. MISO could generate solution ideas, iterating with stakeholders to try and find that best overall solution. And then our final step is cost allocation. And the reason cost allocation is the last step in the process is we try to approach planning as to address a set of issues and let that drive the outcomes rather than the cost allocation piece. A lot of times that does get sort of mixed together. Folks want to know what the potential cost allocation could be going into a study, and so there's some back and forth with that. I'll mention, too, the OMS principles that were sent did note cost allocation and a desire to not necessarily do that at the very end of a process, but perhaps after some initial work had been done, you get some candidate projects, you kind of know the general feel of what's going on, then you can start talking about what an appropriate cost allocation could be. You know, our approach has always been we want to find the right projects. If the cost allocation that we have is not a good fit, we'll go change the cost allocation. We've done that several times in our history, and we'll continue to do that. We don't see it as a rigid one-and-done kind of topic. Any questions on this? Okay. So I'm going to hand the baton to Tony, and he's going to talk a little bit about our futures process. Tony, go ahead.
All right. So the first question is you might have is, what is a future? So think of it as just more of a scenario. So when we say we're developing multiple futures, what we're really saying is we're developing multiple forward-looking scenarios of what the future could be. So we know it's hard to accurately predict what the future has in store for us, if not impossible. So that's why we utilize this concept to help hedge against the uncertainty of what the future holds, as well as to book in a range of economic, political, and technological possibilities. The goal of the futures is to set or to define a set of futures that are broad, to help hedge against those uncertainties of what the future has, as well as helping ensure that any transmission that we may recommend be built will provide benefits to consumers and provide value regardless of what the future could be. So what are the futures used for? So once we work with our membership and our stakeholders in defining the futures and the relative assumptions that are embedded inside those futures, they're used to run a regional resource analysis. The intent of that analysis is to economically identify new resources that may be necessary to meet forecasted load or planning reserve margins 15 to 20 years out into the future, while considering the various different assumptions and constraints that is embedded into each of the futures.
And Tony, let me just add a couple things. So the model that Tony just mentioned is a model that, you know, many utilities and states use in their own IRP planning, their resource planning. You know, it looks at what the most economic expansion of the generation is, given the inputs that you provide it. We scale that way up and apply it on a MISO regional basis rather than on any individual state or utility basis. I also just want to hit again something Tony mentioned is, you know, there's a couple reasons why we do this. One is kind of risk management. So looking out to the future, you know, if you set your bookends far enough apart to guide your planning, you should be able to come up with a plan that if there are incremental changes between those bookends, it doesn't completely undermine what you've planned for. So it's a risk management technique that we utilize. And then the other piece is kind of the more practical one, which is something I mentioned at the top, is, you know, our generation interconnection queue tends to drop off after about 5 years. So you can use those resources in the queue to guide you up to a point. But if you want to build those longer term models, get farther out in the future, you need to make some assumptions about what that generation mix could be to build those cases. So those are a couple of the key reasons why we do this technique in our planning process.
I would add too, just a reminder that our role is never to direct where to put generation. In other words, but we have to make some assumptions around where we think generation is going to show up in order to do transmission planning. So even though we don't have any say in where things are sited and what fuel types are put out there or anything like that, we have to come up with these futures that will allow us to test what our robust transmission, but it's all transmission planning based. It's not feeding into, you know, any direction around who should build what where.
But at the same time, when I was reading the report, and was that 2012 or 2013, the MVP projects?
2011.
So the answer is no. But when I read that report, it talked about new generation coming online without those 17 projects. I mean, in some ways, when I look at the Big Stone to Ellendale line, it was really an on-ramp for new wind development in that part of the world. So when you're saying you're not picking a generation type, you're opening the door for specific types of generation. So right. I'd say you're heavily influencing what's going to be able to come online with those projects.
Right. And you're exactly right to point out the MVP projects as being a little bit different of a planning process than what we're talking about here. That was a very special event. We're actually going to talk about that separately. But again, because you're right, because there was not just a cost-driven driver there. There was a policy driver on that one, and you know, seven different state governors directing us basically to, we have state RPS goals to meet, and we think the best way to meet those goals is to, for you to think, what's the least cost economic solution for putting that much wind into the system. So that was a problem that was given to us, and we were asked to come up with a solution that would be a least cost solution for the region, really.
Okay. Well, then I'll get to what I was most curious about, and that is how the new approach differs from that approach. How the new approach differs from that approach, and that it's not just being reframed, if you will, but it's essentially the same at the end of the day. So that was just one of the questions. Yeah. Small one.
Just a little.
Thanks.
Yeah, and I'll probably touch on that. I don't know that I'll get all the way there because we're still working through it too. But there are some differences, I think, that I will highlight when we talk about the MVPs. At least give us a head start.
My next slide just kind of summarizes some of the many items that are, or assumptions that we consider when we're developing the futures with our stakeholders and membership. So some of the more key factors would be your assumptions on demand and energy, basically your load growth, along with fuel prices, cost to build specific resource types, as well as kind of the tax incentives, which has been big in recent years with the wind and solar, with the production and investment tax credits, as well as kind of what you're assuming as far as load-modifying resources around electric vehicles or distributed generation and storage.
And Tony, in our I think maybe you'll get to it here in a second. In our current set of futures, do we have variations in gas price?
We do.
Okay.
So actually, kind of a good segue into our the next slide. This slide does a depicts the our most recent futures and resource forecasting efforts through the MTEP 19 initiative. And it also kind of frames it in light of the resource mix that's been evolving over the last 18 plus years. And so on the bottom half of the slide, you can see each of the four futures that we have in MTEP 19. And it kind of ratchets it up, in the way that the variables are kind of from a more conservative approach to status quo to kind of more aggressive type futures. So the limited fleet change, as the name suggests, is basically kind of highlighting a stalled generation fleet change, limited renewables driven primarily by the renewable portfolio standards. And then we kind of move gradually through the futures to the continued fleet change, which is kind of more of a status quo perspective. And then the two futures on the right are unique in a sense that the accelerated fleet change is really modeling a more aggressive renewables and demand-side technologies at a rate higher than historical trends. It also models some carbon emissions. And the distributed and emerging technologies future is really kind of digging into distributed resources as well as storage in the region.
What type of assumptions are you using when I'm looking at the coal?
Like retirements or?
Okay, so the 30% is worst case scenario. With
yeah, I'd have to go back and dig up the prices for the basically coal fuel price assumptions. We do have age-based retirement assumptions, and I believe we're using 65 years of life for most of the futures.
Factor in early retirements as well that aren't.
Yeah, so that's one of the things
announced right now, but will happen.
Yeah, so that's one of the things we've been noticing is some of our members are being more aggressive on kind of the fleet change. And so we're seeing, some retirements that may be coming earlier than kind of what our retirement assumptions are. And it's not just on the coal, but you're also seeing it, some on the nuclear front as well.
Yeah. So we would bake that into our next round of futures will probably look a little different in that respect, right?
Yep.
So do you assume that a nuclear waste depository will never occur?
I don't think that's part of one of our future assumptions, but it could be.
Yeah, I mean, we essentially on the nukes assume that they will continue in service. We look at announcements. Most of our economic-based retirements are around the coal fleet. But when we do see, decommissioning retirements of those units, we would include that into our assumptions. They become a base assumption at that point.
Yep. Yeah.
The nuclear ones are easier because they come in big chunks of relicensing, 10, 20, 40 years. So they have to get an NRC license to extend. However they go out forward, they may end up going, reapplying to extend, but they tend to be the easiest things to predict, frankly, as far as what's going to remain on the grid.
Couple notes I will add, kind of wrap up Tony's discussion on the futures. We had proposed, so futures had become kind of an annual process where we take a fresh look. Sometimes we'll redefine the future. Sometimes we'll just update assumptions. We were kind of midstream in that process for our MTEP 20 cycle, and we were getting a lot of questions, a lot of feedback, a lot of interest in kind of taking a step back and doing some education, you know, more of a wholesale review of the futures than we had been pursuing. And so we had proposed that we go ahead and stop work on what we'd call our MTEP 20 futures and begin now on kind of a complete revamp of the futures for futures, sorry, for the next cycles. It's hard not to overuse that word. So what I think is a few reasons for that. One is a lot of our members had not participated with us when we initially developed this approach and this technique. So they didn't have the privilege of going through that and helping develop it. And so we think it's a good time just from an education standpoint. It's been a while since we took a look at some of these base assumptions. We think there's some process improvement areas that we can pursue. So we're going to start later this summer really with, you know, baseline education, why we do this, what futures are in the MISO planning process, then move into some discussion around process improvements and what some of our underlying assumptions are, and then move into really a clean slate discussion on what a new set of futures could be. So, you know, one couple areas that we'll be at least suggesting to stakeholders and proposing in that process is, you know, one, to cut back on the number of futures. There's been times when we've had five or six futures. Currently we have four. You know, our hypothesis is that, you know, maybe we could get down to three if they were sufficiently broad enough to capture those uncertainties in the middle. So that's something that we're going to suggest and discuss with stakeholders over the coming months. Another piece of this is there's going to be analysis coming into that process that's been going on to help inform what those futures could be. So a big one that you may recognize is what we call the REIA studies, the Renewable Integration Impact Assessment Study. It's a lot of words. But what it's been looking at is that different penetration levels of renewables, is there some inflection point where the system can no longer handle that level of wind and solar and other renewables? So, you know, what that is showing is kind of around that 40% penetration level, things start to get kind of hairy from a reliability standpoint. You know, so we'll be bringing in that information, other analysis from the industry to help inform, you know, what could be in that future case.
When you say that, it's not that there's a right answer, right?
Correct.
There's that point for a given region at a given time based on their right. customer base, right?
Yeah. So this is a MISO region look. Yeah, it's a ballpark, right? It's looking at kind of major chunks. Yeah.
One RTO's.
Sure. Yeah, each
saturation
system.
Saturation point would be different than another's.
Exactly.
And then that would change over time depending on
on
your your customer load, how distributed they are throughout the day.
Yeah, it's kind of looking at, okay, based on what the system is today, you start adding incremental levels of renewables, there's some point where the system just can't handle it anymore. And so that's a large part of what that reassessment is. And like I said, for us, it's looking around 40%. It starts to get interesting. So
that's renewables, wind, solar, excluding hydro.
Yeah. There's other analysis that we've been doing around penetration of electric vehicles, just the overall electrification of the transmission of the grid. So we're going to pull from several different places to bring into that discussion of what the futures could be to help inform. And again, it's not trying to pick one. It's saying, let's set our guide rails wide enough so that what actually does happen, what we've planned for, can fall within that range. Timing-wise, we're thinking that RIA, there's some workshops that are being worked on, I think, in August and September. So we'll start to see those come out in that time frame, and then we'll probably have additional discussions in a MTEP futures-type workshop where we'll hit on that again. So look for that information to start rolling out, and you can start digesting what it means for North Dakota and your thoughts on it.
Is that RIA study, is it then conclusive, or is it going to be ongoing?
I think it's going to be ongoing. So this is phase two. There's likely going to be additional phases. We'll keep adding elements to it. That's my sense at the moment.
Yeah, I think the original idea around it was, well, let's keep going all the way up to 80-90% and see what really happens.
Mm-hmm.
But when we started to see that this added complexity kicking in at, 40%, we got more feedback from our stakeholders that said, well, let's stop there for now and drill down on what that really means. What would it take to get over that hurdle? Because when we say, it gets more complex, what we're saying is, it's harder to solve the problems that creates. It doesn't mean you can't get there. It just means it's probably going to cost you more in additional transmission, in additional load-supporting resources, in higher curtailment levels or something. It's going to be less economically efficient because you're going to have higher cost to get to that level. So you need, well, two things. You need to plan for it as opposed to just letting it happen. But it is something that is going to cost more. So it's both the time and money aspect of that complexity at 40%. The other thing I'll say about 40%, again, that is a MISO footprint wide number. And when we step back and say, if we were going to get 40%, how would it likely play out in MISO? That means this region would be at much higher levels of renewable penetration. We'd probably be at 60, 70, 80% in basically this part of MISO that we sit in today. So a lot of the problems that Jesse's referring to in RIA that are being identified are showing up here in the north. So we would, have to figure out what the cost of solving those challenges would be.
They are or are not?
We are projecting that they would show up here in the north. Okay. So therefore, the fixes for those problems would have to show up here as well.
But then why would we have a higher penetration?
Why would we have a higher?
Yeah.
Basically because a couple things. One is we see the most economic wind resources being here,
mm-hmm.
right? So when it comes to particularly wind resources, it's still, cheapest to build it up in this part of the world where the resource is better. So it's just more of a quality of the resource thing. Solar is a little bit different. It's a little bit more distributed, but you see more of that in the south because the irradiance numbers get better. But right now, those are just engineering assumptions based on, we think it's going to flow out that way, and we also get some indication from our generation or connection queue that others, developers, that's where they're placing their bets, too. That gives us a little bit of an indication, and that's what we see. We've seen a lot of wind up in the north, solar more in the south. If there's anything that's a little surprising out of that, we're starting to see more and more solar up in the northern part of the footprint, even more than we've assumed in our RIA work. Our queue right now, our generation interconnection queue, is 100 gigawatts of projects, sitting in our queue, and it's 60% solar.
Mm.
It used to be that's footprint wide, but it used to be predominantly wind, and very quickly, in the last 2 years, that has flipped, and it's now 60% solar and about 30% wind.
So the 40% penetration assumes that there's this high penetration of wind up north, and that's why you're having because it is such a high penetration.
Right.
I see. Okay.
Yep. So you figure, and maybe you're getting to it, so you figure that point out and conclude it's 40%. But now companies say, well, we're still closing our base loads, and we're going to build some more wind and solar farms, and
That's what we're going to have. What do you do about it?
I mean, it's a data point, yeah. Right? It's not the answer. So you got to look at that. You got to look at trends. What policies could come down the pike? All of that feeds into kind of defining that what could happen. You know, there's always a degree of iterating along the way. You know, the goal is to, if you look far enough out in the future and set your parameters wide enough, those incremental changes along the way should fit in with that overall longer range plan with some tweaks. It's not something, again, you would do for 20 years out in the future today and there'd never be any tweaks or changes or, you know, I think that's going to happen. So some of it is adjusting as you get more information.
Yeah, the challenge here is it's, you know, it's, you said 2011 when the MVP projects, all of those projects are still underway being built. I mean, it's a 12-year process from, you know, idea to completion to get that stuff up. It takes that long. So there's a, you know, if the fleet's going to change rapidly, we have to be thinking about these scenarios farther out so that we can respond to policy changes. And again, we're, MISO is a policy taker, not a policy maker. You know, we're trying to, we've got a different set of policies in every state that we, in our footprint. And our job is to help those states meet those policy, their own policy objectives. And they may be different, but help each state meet its policy objectives in the least cost and reliable manner.
Brian, I've heard Claire say multiple times, though, from MISO, you might be a policy taker, but you're also running a market. And I've heard him say that you guys are responsible, or the market is responsible for sending the right market signals to have the resources that it needs to be reliable. Mm-hmm. And so that's the tool that you guys have.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is making sure that you're sending the right signals to the resources that you need to be reliable. So you aren't just like, well, companies do whatever they want.
Exactly.
You guys have to
be
operating it in a way that sends those important signals so that we don't lose all the resources that are needed.
That's exactly why we do things like the RIA study, because, you know, we know that in the future we're going to need a market product that puts more value on flexibility. Mm-hmm. We don't know when that'll show up, but we're going to need to work on that. And that today the market doesn't value that flexibility in a way. I mean, we've got products in the market. We've got a ramp capability product in the market today, and it prices out at basically free because it's that product is in surplus on the grid today. The problem is when we look out into the future, we're worried that there won't be enough of it. So we're going to have that product in place, you know, before before the future shows up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, let's continue on. So we've talked a bit about kind of the process for how we approach transmission planning, some of the work that's coming up here in the near future. What this slide gets to is, what are the elements needed for us to take those plans and take them to the next step of approval by our board of directors, which then comes with an obligation for an owner or developer to construct those projects. And so there's three key elements here. One is the business case. We need to show that these projects are indeed valuable, and there's a justification for building them and charging customers to have those transmission lines. The other element is we've called policy consensus. You could also think of it as sort of general agreement of the issues you're trying to address. you know, the reality within MISO is you'll never have full consensus on really anything, but we seek to get as much support as we can, especially when it comes to transmission planning, and a lot of that ties back to the next element, which is the cost allocation. There needs to be a cost allocation that matches those who benefit with those who pays. And, you know, as I mentioned before, that's an area where we want to plan to the issues first. If the cost allocation doesn't fit, we'll go change it. Okay. Any questions on that before I get into MVP stuff? So a couple thoughts on MVP, and then I'll try to get to the question about what's different, kind of from where we're at now, from where we were back in 2010-2011. Just from a status standpoint, most of the MVPs are through their regulatory approval process. We just had a hearing in Wisconsin on Cardinal Hickory Creek. So we're participating in and monitoring that project, but pretty much all the others have gone through their regulatory process. Several are already in service or under construction. So, and, you know, to Brian's point, this is a long process. These projects were approved in 2011, you know, creeping on 10 years from when those projects were approved to having steel in the ground. But it is a positive development that those are nearing completion. Let's go to the next slide. We'll spend a little time here. You know, I know that a question that we've received is, you know, are the MVPs fully subscribed? You know, have we maxed out the capacity that we had planned for with that MVP portfolio? And the short answer is essentially yes. We planned for around 21 gigs of wind that was the sort of underlying generation assumption for the MVP portfolio. We're at, I think, 19 and counting as far as installed wind capacity in MISO, and that continues to grow. The map that you're looking at, so a couple interesting things on this map, and I think some of you may have seen it before, maybe all of you. So first, the blue circles. So this is going back quite a ways, but as we were doing the planning.
Jesse, you're talking about the light blue.
I'm sorry, yeah. The light blue circles, thank you. They're ovals, most of them. When we were doing the planning for the MVPs, a big, probably the biggest factor was looking at the state RPS requirements that were rolling out at that time. And we did several studies that looked at kind of the all-in cost. So what I mean by that is we looked at scenarios that said, well, if you put all of the wind just where the wind is has the highest capacity factors, you'll lower your generation costs, but you'll have much higher transmission costs. Then we looked at the other extreme, said, well, if you just put all the wind right next to the load where these RPSs are popping up, you have really high generation costs, but you can minimize your transmission costs. So we did analysis that looked at those relative cost extremes. We also looked at each of the individual states had different requirements. Some had certain percentages that had to be within the state. Some, you know, half could be in state, half could be out of state. So we looked at the overall costs. We looked at the policies. We worked with stakeholders and developed this set of what we called regional generation outlet study zones. So that's the RGOS that you see is what that stands for. And it said these are the places that we think, based on the policies, the wind, I think Sam showed the chart with the wind capacities. We looked at information from NREL and others, say where are the likely places where these resources are going to show up? Where does it make the most sense from an overall economic value? We'll develop these set of zones. when we build our models, that's where we're going to site our wind resources and then build our transmission plan off of that.
When you say stakeholders, are you talking utilities, I'm assuming, but also did you go directly to developers, wind developers?
Yeah.
And where do your studies point you in terms of where you'd like to put a facility, but you need an interconnect?
Yep. Yeah, so all of this was developed at the time through a series of workshops. We had a similar committee structure, but we did a lot of stakeholder workshops. We invited everyone, including, you know, commission staffs, any stakeholder across our spectrum of stakeholder groups, environmental groups, owners, developers, loads, you know, brought everyone to the table to get input in developing these zones.
What did the zones, repeat again what the zones, those?
So it was our estimation of where the wind would locate based on all those factors, and then we built the transmission out from there. So the notion being, this is the most likely place where the wind is going to show up based on the policies and the physics. We'll build the transmission from there. If resources choose to locate other places, which we're seeing, you know, they may have higher costs to interconnect than to the system because they're not as close to that MVP build out as others. Another interesting thing that this map shows is we do see, in spite of that, we do see higher penetration levels in this part of the MISO footprint. Mm-hmm. So they're going above and beyond what we had included in those zones. So you're seeing more resources show up in the Dakotas, Minnesota, Iowa. You're not seeing as much in, you know, you can see that Illinois zone and that Missouri zone. You know, not a lot of activity in some of those other places.
And this map is as of 2016, so
yeah,
there's been a lot more.
It's a little dated. We haven't updated this in a while, but you could kind of just scale it up.
we do a triennial review of the MVP projects, go back and relook at every 3 years, you know, are the benefits still there, are the costs still there? And basically, every time we do that review, the benefits, we end up concluding we wish we'd built them bigger. Basically, because everything that we thought would happen is and more. So,
to the question earlier about, well, what's different, I think a couple things that I would highlight. One is you don't have necessarily that rush of new state renewable portfolio standards. So a lot of the activity is driven on economics from the developer side, interest from the load side. Some states are doing additional push for renewables, others aren't. So I think that's one difference. We're still seeing all these resources wanting to come into the system and creating challenges for us, but they're driven not necessarily by state requirements. The other factor that's a little different, I think, is now with solar and the change in the makeup of the MISO footprint. Mm-hmm. So your potential diversity benefits could be different. The resource mix on our system overall is different than it was. Those are just a couple that stand out to me kind of going into this process. And that was what we had. I'm happy to take any questions or comments that you may have.
What does RGO stand for?
Yeah, so it stands for Regional Generation Outlet Study. So we did a dedicated analysis just to look at where these zones should be.
Yeah. I usually characterize it as the MVP process was a build it and they will come kind of approach, which we were asked to develop. So it's different than what we normally do with our normal planning process, since it was policy driven, not designed to just lower average production cost or improve reliability, which is the main driver for everything else.
Yeah, and was there a governor's group kind of driving that?
Yeah, it's the Midwest Governors Association.
Is the Midwest Governors doing that again?
I don't know.
I've heard that there is something going on.
I think there have been some announcements from MGA. Mm-hmm. What we got in 2011, and this is seared in Claire's memory, you get a letter signed by six or seven governors, I think it was seven, from these states up here saying, you know, we need you to do this to help us meet our policy objectives. And that was the thing that was so different about the MVP process. Mm-hmm. That which, in retrospect, you know, thank goodness we did that. From a standpoint of, you know, assuming you wanted to get there, you know, this was the way to do it and at least cost way of doing it. Mm-hmm. Now, whether it's the right direction to go or not is not something that
you guys
determine. Yeah.
There was one last thing I would add in there. you know, there was a cost allocation factor too. Mm-hmm. So we, at the time, for generation interconnections, the costs were split basically 50% to the local zone where the unit was connecting to, and the other 50% would go to the rest of the footprint. You think about the magnitude of the resources coming in with transmission upgrade costs in the billions of dollars, half of that going to those local zones that were in North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota. You know, it's an illustration of what I mentioned before, that if the cost allocation just isn't right, we'll work to fix it. But that was a major factor leading up to the MVPs as well.
Right.
Thank you.
All right. No more questions there. Should we shift gears? We're going to shift gears dramatically here. We're going to go from a 10, 20, 30-year time horizon down to the second, minute, maybe day ahead, maybe 7 days ahead time horizon, which is the world Mike lives in our control center. So we've got to reorient our thinking here for this different time horizon.
Thanks, Brian. I'm going to go over some of the events we've had over the last couple years, even touch a little bit, even back to the original polar vortex, well, at least first called that anyway. And highlighting, first of all, on the January event, 30th and 31st of, starting the 29th, of this year, 2019. Make a comment about below negative 30 in some parts of our regions, and I'm sure up here, along with us in Minnesota, we definitely saw below negative 30 degrees Fahrenheit. So it was extremely cold. As you get into those levels that don't happen often, your uncertainties of load generation, they certainly increase at that point. We did reliably manage the operations during those days using our emergency procedures from early on the 30th through the afternoon of the 31st. We have done winter preparedness. This was an extreme case of winter, and so we have lessons learned that have come out of that that we are continuing to improve on as we go into our subsequent winters. Some of them translate to you know, other times of the year too. So we'll go through some of those. The next slide. This shows a couple of different events. One, again, the January 30 and 31st of this current year up in the north and central region, and then January 17th of 2018 in our south region at the time. The locational marginal pricing maps show the difference in costs in this case, the oranges, high prices. That's where the heavy loads are during that time. The dark blues and the blues, much lower cost. You're trying to get generation there. There may be some bottlenecks along the way. So the does some comparisons. When we talk about temperatures in these slides, it's a load-weighted temperature is how we do it. So you look at the large geographical regions up here of the north and central regions. You look at the various load amounts in certain cities, temperatures there, so you can come up with a MISO temperature in real time for that way. So when you see a minimum temperature of minus 26, that takes into all the different places in the north and central regions. Certainly still a very low temperature. Previous year, the minimum temperature of 13 degrees. Now you're looking at the Arkansas's, Louisiana's, Mississippi's, and Texas. So again, a very low temperature for that region, and thus the event that occurred down there. There were some similarities with those temperatures. Some of the things that we saw were load forecasts. The load forecast this time coming through did a fairly good job. You'll see on a couple slides coming up here, there were still temperature variations on what had been planned for in the day ahead, what happened in real time. Unplanned outages always impact the current day as we go through a day ahead process, planning for that real time. And then when you do ask additional generation resources to start or stay online, there may be some forced outages that impact the operations. We've got an acronym here of LMRs, load modifying resources. Those are some of the planned load attributes that our members have that we can call upon to relieve some of the load. And in this case, in each of the things, we identified how much we're scheduled during those times. Emergency purchases in the 2018 event, as that south load increased, resources did either not start or had been forced off. We did get into our emergency purchases from our neighbors in that time frame. So it came so we could supply the load in the south region. We were up against the upper limits on the, as you see, the regional dispatch transfer from the north and central region through the area there, Arkansas and that area up into the Illinois, Indiana, Missouri area. That amount, certain limits that are agreed to, we were at those limits and above. So those emergency purchases allowed us to serve the load down there without having to shed firm load. So you see the variations. And in this year, when we were in our north and central region, we did not need to do any emergency purchases at that point.
One point I'd like to make there is the reason we didn't have to do emergency purchases was because there was a massive amount of imports coming in naturally. I mean, it's a good thing we don't have to do emergency purchases because the pricing when you're in emergency purchases is much higher. But prices in MISO were high enough that sent a signal to a bunch of gas units in PJM sitting on the Marcellus Shale, and they pumped at one point 13 gigawatts of capacity of power into MISO. And that became that was the main source of the solution, or a big source of the solution that we got there was those relatively efficient imports from RTO to RTO. It's something we forget sometimes when we talk about RTOs, but that is one thing that, you know, they need to do is make that a very fluid flow of market-based information. Because when that price signal shows up, like it was on January 30th, the folks in PJM saw it, and you know, things worked out.
Correct. Thank you.
What if those resources had been needed in PJM?
If they hadn't been available,
yeah,
we would have had to go someplace else, you know, to get them. We would have had to go into emergency purchases. So we would have gotten the electricity, but we probably would have paid a lot more for it.
Brian, is there ever, like, we always assume that the electricity is going to be there to get. What if it isn't? I mean, do we prepare for that possibility that there is a finite amount of electricity that's going to be available? And
we prepare, you know, we do load shedding type drills as far as how to actually go out and act through that scenario. If it ever got to the point where you know, the system collapsed and you do restoration, but that's a large step beyond that. So the capacity procedures, the emergency procedures have a number of steps. In here, we're getting into I'll just call it a step two. That's it's a fair ways into our emergency, but there's still multiple steps beyond that before we would get to firm load shedding. So we've got operating reserves. We've got those emergency purchases that we can do. LMRs, this is what was scheduled. There may be additional LMRs we can call upon. There's emergency ranges that for generators and even the demand response that we can get to. So there are multiple steps beyond this before we reach that. And then if everything goes at that point and you're at that point where you have to start taking off some load, you would. And you would depend on your emergency area. You would take that in to your best benefit at that point. So.
Page 21 has that list.
Along those lines, though, I'll tell you what concerns me, and I've asked this question of some others before and never really gotten the answer that comforts me the way I'm looking for. It seems to me we throw around terms like polar vortex because we like to make whatever is happening seem like a big deal in a story. I look at, and I don't know about the southern region at all, but I look at what you highlight as a big deal, and maybe over the last 20 years it was a big deal, but historically in the 125 years or so that North Dakota has records, it's not a big deal. That weather system was just kind of cold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Really cold.
It's not a big deal. I don't like
it. Really cold. Well, yeah,
but I think compared to 64 below or whatever it was in partial, you know, back in the 30s, and then even sometimes in the more recent past,
right,
there's been much more extremes than this, and same on heat. And so are we looking back far enough and considering really worst-case scenarios or just kind of bad scenarios?
I think as you look at the north and central region from this year, we got into our step two's version of that where we're looking at some of those load-modifying resources. But that's also to say all we went to. So we're certainly highlighting this as an event. Big deal or close to an extreme, we still had a ways to go in these regions before there was any dire circumstances. So if you look at years ago, and we talked, I think we've talked some about, you know, changing portfolio. So over the years of some of these retirements and our planning reserve margins are not as high as they used to be. So you are closer to having to step into those first couple steps of a maximum generation capacity that gets you into there and makes it look bigger. It is a big deal because you don't want to go any further than you have to, but it was managed well and reliably.
You have more steps you can take.
Yes.
Yeah. Page 21 shows all the steps if you're interested, but. And we're not trying to make a big deal about it, but anytime something like that happens, we do jump on it as a great opportunity for lessons learned, right? Because it's an extreme event. And what was really different about this one was that, you know, in 1964, we didn't have 19 gigawatts of wind on the system. You know, we do now, and it went away fast. It dropped off really fast, and that wasn't in our forecast. So we learned a lot about some things we needed to do differently about forecasting wind, as we've learned to try to manage that new resource over time. So our drilling down on this is mainly because that's our nature is, you know, a crisis is how we learn. You know, thank goodness this crisis was averted and didn't, but that creates still a learning opportunity.
Thank you. So the next slide 16, talks about conclusions and lessons learned around the 2018 event. So that was the more of the South Region event. Certainly the coordination within MISO with all of our members, with the neighboring reliability coordinators, we're coordinating with them every day. So it's that those drills around the emergency processes, they allow us to reliably manage this. Again, we come out of it with lessons learned, but that was one of them that happened back a year and a half ago. demand-side management and load-modifying resources. We're learning as we implement some of those to get to further enhance that. So that it was a different area that had load-modifying resources this year, north and central versus south. So there hasn't been a lot of use of that over the years. So each time we're learning more about that. Those emergency energy purchases, while we didn't use them this time, the process to get to them if we needed them was much clearer this time. We, in January of 2018, we accomplished it. It was rough, but we did accomplish it with some of our neighbors. In advance of this year, we had already reached out to those neighbors knowing who could provide it if we needed it. We had drilled on that with each of those entities. That would have happened quickly, and it would have those purchases would have happened. So that was something we learned in January of 18 that was, although not needed, it was better suited this time. And then we're always looking at the emergency pricing as we go through these events.
Did you receive any pushback or negative comments on the demand side management from folks who you had to call on?
Each time we do that, then we're waiting to analyze what came in, and we go through settlement process with that. So the our processes and our tools, we do know those certainly needed to be enhanced there. We've gotten a little bit better, but continue to enhance it, some of it with the tools, so that the members can get in there easily to let us know what is available. We've had some more recent filings that further go into those details. And yes, there were definitely some comments back to us on how we could improve it, and we've been working on that and continue to work on it even now. Because again, this time around, it was a different set of people that used them, so we got further comments there. So the next slide, as we didn't mention, this is back to this year now, is kind of an overview of what happened over those days. So I'll highlight the solid blue line, day-ahead wind forecast. So we go through a forecast with our vendor. This is showing, what this shows is based on wind speed. This is a outlook of, we're up pretty high, we're at 14 gigawatts here, the scale on the left, transitioning through that night. Still in the morning peak hours, we're still up at 8 gigawatts that we were planning on for that morning. And then just based on wind speed alone, different fronts coming through, we're going to tail off into the less than 4 gigawatts here as we go through the 30th. And that was all what was planned for. So the day-ahead plan, the reliability plan going into the 30th was set up for those type of numbers. The green line, the green full bar, is what the actual wind that did happen during this time frame. So you can see where the forecast and actual on the far left were matching well. But then late afternoon on the 29th, you can start seeing the solid green tailing off here rather quickly. Some of it, a portion of it was wind speeds that were starting to drop off in the far west side of our footprint, so the Montanas and western North Dakota, but the cold temperatures came in during that time overnight, and this is a bulk of low temperature cutouts for the wind farms themselves that they shut down based on the temperature to make sure they are not damaged in any way.
Was that like 20-80 split if you had to attribute a little less wind, but the majority of it was just having to shut down?
Right. So it's a majority of it is the low temperature cutout. Small portion of it in the beginning was wind speed dropping off, but those early morning hours were the low temperature cutouts.
So. I should probably know this, but I don't. And do you have a sense of, I don't even know from looking at it from an economics point of view, retrofitting some of those turbines? with heater jackets, that type of thing? Or I know the new models, newer, or some of the older models probably did too, but now the ones that are going in, it seems like they're equipped to handle the cold.
There are different versions, different requirements. They can install cold weather packages that allow them to go a little colder. My understanding of what's mostly installed, it's in that minus 25 area Fahrenheit that's going to start getting into these. So MISO doesn't have a requirement that says you have to be good to minus 40.
No, right.
There are places that do that farther north even yet, but
so they'll stretch it with the existing facilities, but more on the new construction side that'll come in.
Since this happened, that we've had a couple siting hearings, and I've asked about the cold weather packages, and they aren't this cold. Even the cold weather packages get to the minus 30. Right. They're in the early to low to mid 20s, it seems like. So there, and maybe I'm just misreading it, but there seems to be a little bit of a disconnect between at least the few people that speak to us on the siting side and the operational side on what, you know, what they're covering in terms of cold weather.
Right.
Yeah. And I think it's a good question to ask. I mean, we'll do a better job of forecasting this now that we know some of those things that are out there. But for the developer, I think it's a hard decision to make. You know, I put an expensive cold weather package on so I can run, you know, in this event that only occurs once every 5 years. So economically, they look at it and say, well.
But you guys have to have the good data.
I'm not going to do it.
Yeah, you guys have to have the good data. Maybe, I don't know if you do, what temperature they'll operate on.
That's going to be one of our lessons learned here that we'll show in another slide or two around that data. We were aware, certainly in the operations side, that this did happen. We didn't have the exact numbers built into our wind forecasting capability and some of our processes to know here's what to expect in here.
Mm-hmm.
So we've since gathered the data, getting it to our wind forecaster so that we can expect a wind forecast that would take into account those temperature based in addition to wind speed. So we would expect to see a cleaner forecast going into that, which then backs us all the way up into the day ahead where we're not anticipating as much. So you'd have other generation that may start earlier. Because what happened here was, I think I got my phone call about 1 in the morning after we were already 3 or 4 gigs lower than what was anticipated. So we were declaring that max gen event at 5 o'clock in the morning and start asking generators to start that. While they're there, they've offered in and available to start, they weren't anticipating it. So additional anticipation of that, they can set themselves up better to start also in those temperatures. So we had forced outages that were higher than you'd think at those times. You know, forced outage of maybe not starting at that point. So some of that happened, and again, we had enough, large enough geographical footprint of north and central regions that there was enough generation to start to get us through those morning hours. And as you look at later that afternoon, 1500, we were at that point forecast and wind again matched each other, and that was as much wind speed as anything there. So there's a little bit of some of the dashed line and the solid line is showing it was colder temperatures in real time compared to day ahead, so that is going to impact both those low temperature cutouts and your load a little bit. Not significant, but significant enough across the full footprint that we did manage through some of those differences also. Next slide, we talk a little bit around the failed starts and the outage uncertainties that you get. You can see from the 29th into the 30th there, where there was almost 10 gigawatts of generation outages and derates. So it may not force a generator off, but maybe a derate comes in that says, you know, we're only good to this amount of megawatts instead of the full, full megawatts because of a particular reason what that might be. So those to us in real time, it doesn't matter. At that point, it's not usable, so it looks like an outage. So we dealt with those additional 10 gigawatts of outages on the 30th, and it stayed around that same level for the 31st. And it was a different day-ahead setup going into the 31st. At that point, we knew, just based on wind speed alone, that we weren't going to have as much wind. That had been built into that forecast and that day-ahead plan. So there was, even in that time, over the 30th and 31st, we kept some generation online that maybe we would normally shut down just for economics overnight. We kept it online. Again, easier to stay online running than try to start again in the cold the next morning when the actual load starts picking up. So there was some of that built into that 31st to a cleaner real-time process there. So. Well, let's touch here. I think we probably mentioned most of them around some of our lessons learned from January of 2019. The wind forecasting with additional parameters. Got that in process. We had a wind forecasting workshop that we held. Talked a little bit about our processes. Some of the load forecast and the amount of school closings. So you want to build that into the load forecast itself. You're looking at temperature-based load forecast, but then you have, I think Wisconsin closed down every school. Other ones, it was based on school district by school district, and those, certainly still a large majority of the schools were closed. So that impacts the load that you see, building that into the forecast and looking at that.
So how much does every school in the state of Wisconsin impact load?
Yeah, I haven't seen that number other than as you're getting into these steps where you're calling on load modifying resources and you're down in that 1 or 2 gigawatt area there, it matters. In those are similar types of levels where some of those schools, they're not in service, but they're still heating them, just maybe probably to a lower temperature. So you still got load there. It's just you're just trying to fine-tune those emergency steps as much as you can, so you don't call in any more LMRs than you have to, but trying to have the most accurate forecast that you can. So I know I don't have an answer.
It's fine.
But it is something that we recognize as a improvement we can maybe make.
That's what I seem all like home. A negative. They all went home and turned up the thermostat on thousands of them.
Yeah. And yeah. Are playing video games and hopefully doing laundry for them.
The malls were very busy.
You're speaking from experiences.
Yeah. As always, we review the emergency pricing rules that we have and seeing how they work with, because you need those price incentives to for the imports that come in is one of them, but just the emergency prices that come out to incentivize future resources and just the future market itself. So the LMR, load modifying resource availability and performance, we'll look at that each time that happens, along with the generation availability and performance. So we do a winter readiness, looks at mostly gas, puts out some questions to the generators about their winter readiness. NERC puts out guidelines for generation winter readiness. So it's always something that all of the generators can look at, not just the wind farms and their low temperature cutouts, but all generation itself. So. There was an event earlier this year, just a little over a month ago, down in the South region again. That one, kind of during the spring outage season, some temperatures came up down in the South region, some additional forced outages down there, put us into the event steps again. This time through, everything was accurate, operated within limits. I went out to verify if there was any emergency purchases. We did not need to go to that step at all. And we did initiate load modifying resources again for a few hours during that event in May. And I think it points to the, I think we state this in our resource plans that we put out each summer and winter, that the likelihood of getting into our max gen procedures and our load modifying resources has increased over the last few years as the portfolio changes. So we've seen that here recently. Next page, it's kind of an outline of some of the emergency operating procedures that we have access to, whether it's severe weather, cold weather, hot weather, geomagnetic disturbances. Any of those, can we can put out those alerts and then go into a conservative system operations that allows us to put the system in a more reliable spot, try to bring back transmission outages. We have asked generators to stop any testing that they might be doing. So a number of instances there where we can set the system up a little more conservative and manage through those events. So those are always in our toolbox to use. If we go beyond that, where we get into on a cold weather or hot weather, we may get into these maximum generation that shows the various steps over here on the right-hand side and what we would do, shows a little bit about emergency pricing on the right side, but some of the NERC levels that we get into, that we're making sure that we're following NERC procedures. So each of those would step through, and all the way down there in step five is where that firm load shed happens. And we were in step two. One of these, we were in step 2AB. One of them, we were in step 2CD. So we've still got a few steps in there with a few gigawatts of energy that can be still counted on before we'd have to get to a firm load shed. So I think the last slide, I won't go into any details other than saying we had lessons learned back from the 2014 polar vortex. Those have all been built into our systems now. We still see, still some of the same ones that come up, that because you don't have many instances of these. So each one you learn again, but that first polar vortex, certainly learned a lot there and built those into our processes and procedures. So I'll kind of pause there with it. I believe that's my last slide.
What is reserve call under step four on the max gen procedures?
Okay. Step four, reserve call. So we have a reserve sharing pool that right now it's MISO as the large balancing authority. We have that with Manitoba. So anytime we need operating reserves, we can go out and share that with them. So that gets used routinely. If a large generator trips, so you've got NERC standards you're required to meet within the first 15 minutes, you can go out and do a reserve call, get help from your neighbor, your participants that are in there. When you're in this stage of step four, now you're saying the you can't maintain your operating reserves, so you're getting reserves and the emergency reserve purchases. So when we talk about emergency purchases up in the steps one, that's just energy that's coming in there. That's step four. Now you're buying. You're saying another entity is going to help you maintain that extra room on your system to help manage if something additional happens. Mm. So it's a last step of, it's an energy transaction, but you're kind of sharing where those reserves are actually located.
Doesn't seem like you have any reserves at that point.
We're still maintaining reserves, so that co-optimized market is doing the energy and the various reserve products. So that continues on down there. So you do have reserves. Mm. So when we're even in step two and all that, we've still got reserves, so we can handle another generator tripping. We carry 2,200 megawatts of reserves for the size of our footprint. So that part of it, we still maintain that. It's that step four is where we're saying, okay, we've used that energy, some of that for load. Now we need to go out and get help for additional reserves to maintain that. So.
Interesting.
All right. Should we move on to the third item? Which I, after hearing those two things, I guess maybe the way to introduce this idea of resource availability need is this is what we're trying to do to address some of the trends that we just talked about. Jesse talked about the evolving fleet, how that's changing a lot, how we're moving toward more of a all hours matter as opposed to planning for a summer peak, and then everything else will work itself out, which is sort of the approach in the past for utility planning generally. And then, although Mike's really good at it, we would prefer he not have emergency events to deal with. We'd rather the problem be prevented than becoming a learning opportunity for more lessons learned.
Well, then he wouldn't have that awesome white hair.
Yeah, it wasn't. It wasn't
just
white.
Everybody on the emergency team does, right?
So resource availability need is a series of steps we're taking, and I'll say the medium term, some quickly and some over the next couple of years, to try to address some of these things that we're seeing today on the grid. It's a three-phase process. We're in the middle of phase two. It is incredibly important, though, because of this sort of narrowing gap between load and the available resources. I mean, when MISO first was formed, we went through this long period of by combining, we ended up with extra reserves on the system. So we had a lot more capacity than we needed. We are now bumping up against that limit of not having as much cushion as we've had in the past. And we're seeing the increased occurrences like Mike talked about. So we've got several focus areas going forward. We're going to talk about how we accredit resources for our planning. In other words, how much credit do we give a wind turbine that may or may not be available? When you're planning for an event, how much do you want to count on wind or any resource, really, you know, in that scenario? And we're realizing that there's some changes we can make there that will be better reflect the accreditation of what's going on. We're looking at seasonal resource adequacy, and I'll talk more about that, but that's basically instead of planning for that summer peak and then assuming you've got enough capacity that everything else works out, you're literally looking at resource adequacy on more of a seasonal basis. So you're looking at it in the spring, the summer, or even by month and in the winter, because frankly, that's when we're seeing the events that give Mike white hair. You know, we're not seeing problems in the summer. You know, we got that one covered.
You just jinxed everything.
I know. Like getting an email saying the group, you know, we got problems. I probably did, but so far the history over the last 2 years, 2.5 years has not been summer problems. It's been shoulder months and winter. So we need to change the way we think about that, and get better in the multi-day time horizon. One of the things we have is a day-ahead market, which helps us a day ahead, but it doesn't really give us or our member companies much advice about what it looks like out in the future, so looking out farther. I mentioned three phases on the next page. If we could move to 24 there. Phase one is essentially already done. And this really started at our September board meeting in St. Paul. And Commissioner Podorczyk, I forget if you were there, but you may recall the discussion. But there was, you know, that was when we'd had a couple emergency events already. There was this fleet change we were talking about, and our board and our stakeholders really said, okay, you know, we really need to get after this. And there's a lot of things we need to fix here. It's going to take some time, but is there anything we can do, like, now, quickly, to get things better so that we're better in, you know, in 2019 as opposed to better in 2021 and 22? So this broke it up into phases about how long things took to fix. One thing we looked at doing a better job of quickly is around LMRs and creating more transparency about how we use those and also outage coordination. Because the trends that we're seeing on outage coordination were very concerning. We didn't talk a whole lot about that here. We talked about it for the events. But we're seeing forced outage trends going up, particularly in the south region of MISO. As units age, as folks maybe aren't investing as much in those older units, so we're seeing forced outage rates go up. And that you know, forced outages has been the common trigger around a lot of these events. And we realized that there was a better way to do that. That is phase one largely, and we made FERC filings around both these categories the fourth quarter of last year, and got approval on the three FERC filings we made in these two categories for that in Q1. So we're already implementing some of these changes around the way we manage LMRs and outage coordination, because they did require changes to our tariff, changes to some of our operating procedures. So we're implementing that now. Phase two is the next thing we're working on, and that's more around our planning resource auction. We haven't talked about that yet today. But think of our markets as our markets are actually very similar to SPPs in a day ahead and real time world. You know, there are differences, but they're more alike than different. One thing that's a little bit different for us is we do have a planning reserve auction, which is a type of capacity market for excess capacity. And we have to do that because we do have retail choice states in MISO. So it's, and it's important for planning.
Which ones are retail choice? Or are there a lot of them?
Illinois, largely. Most of Illinois is, and then parts of Michigan.
Okay.
So for the planning resource auction, and this planning resource auction was, you know, again, something that was designed around that summer peak. Because basically what you're doing in the planning resource auction is looking 1 year ahead. So instead of the real-time or day-ahead markets, this is effectively a year-ahead market for capacity 1 year out. And you bid in for excess capacity. So that's what the planning resource auction is in general. Realizing, though, that planning resource auction needs not to become just a summer auction, but something that is almost constantly rolling forward in that 1 to 2 year time horizon. So you're not just, if you're not just concerned about the summer, how do you adjust the planning resource auction to, first of all, accredit resources properly, and then also account for these seasons where before the planning resource auction wasn't even designed to address. So that's, yes.
Just one question on the planning resource auction. So that's a year ahead. And what happens, what do you call those resources that you actually secure through that auction?
What do we call them?
Like, where are they held, or how are they? You purchase something, right? Somebody commits to it.
That would be.
It's just the
becomes a it becomes a requirement that load purchase that capacity.
It's a financial arrangement. It's not like you're purchasing a thing. I don't know how to describe. Maybe Jesse.
Enough to be dangerous. I could try. So there's a forward requirement established for the footprint, and then there's a zonal element to that. There's basically a database tool that for those load differences that hadn't self-supplied that are going to the auction to mm-hmm. get those excess resources. There's a clearing mechanism that we go through that matches that excess capacity with the load that needs it, and then they'll pay the price that market determines.
Okay.
And yeah. Then there's a database that we have internally that tracks that to make sure that every load-serving entity had met all of their obligations. I'm not sure if that's where you were going with that.
That ensures that when regulators in North Dakota and South Dakota and Wisconsin all hear from utilities saying we're going to purchase the rest of our reserves on the market, that everybody isn't counting on the same reserves.
Right.
Oh, no.
Right.
Right.
So there is enough of reserves to go around to meet everybody's.
Right.
And it accounts for restrictions on importing from one zone to the other, because mm-hmm. you can have that helps out too. But so that's why it varies by zone too.
Okay. Thank you.
And then that translates to the day ahead and that for then they're required to offer into that once they're picked up in the
PRA. Okay.
So that's where it translates there.
Into the market.
I want to add a twist to that because I've had the same concern. So I get that there's records kept and it's firm agreements so that they're all not buying the same thing.
Right.
But if many utilities are counting on doing that over long term, is there what gives us assurance that as they continue to add some each year that they're going to buy on the market, that there is going to be a big enough market to buy it from?
Well, the market is an auction, and there's a lot more units that are unavailable than actually clear in that auction. So what would happen if there's more, the only way to assure that there's enough reserves is the auction would cause the price to go up and up. So the value of those reserves would increase.
Mm-hmm.
And then that'll send a signal that somebody needs to build or bring a different sort of resource into that auction because it would be much more lucrative. Right now, capacity prices in this auction are very, very low. They're almost meaningless. So we don't have a big capacity market like PJM does. Most of the customer issue discussion stuff that goes on in the eastern markets is markets that are more fully deregulated at the wholesale level, and capacity markets are a big thing there. It becomes less of an issue here, but still we need to make it work better for these trends that we're seeing coming at us.
Thank you.
Yeah, Brian, if I may add, there's a couple other things that we do to send kind of a longer-term view. So we will do kind of a 10-year long-term resource assessment that looks out in that time frame on just the system capacity, the installed capacity and load forecasts. And then we also do a survey that we coordinate through the organization of MISO states that then goes to our members and asks them for their longer term plans. So those are, so the auction itself is 1 year out, but we do those couple of additional steps to at least get some visibility into those future resource plans, and it tells us something about what's coming and if there are problems ahead.
So phase three will be around improving resource accreditation. How do we match that resource accreditation with availability? Adding the seasonal aspect to it so it's not just a summer peak, and also improving visibility in the multi-day operating horizon. And I say multi-day because we talked about day-ahead markets, we talked about real-time markets, which are intraday, but we don't currently have markets that go out into the 2 to 7 day time horizon. Well, what's the start time on a coal plant? I mean, it can be more than a day at times, and it's expensive to start. So there are different types of units. It would be very helpful to have a price signal out there in that 2 to 7 day time period too. A first step as far as going that direction is at least giving us and our members a better view into what we think the operating margin is going to be in that 2 to 7 day time horizon. So this is adding visibility for everybody to see the same thing coming. So if Mike's got this, we want Mike to be able to see, hey, 4 days out, we think we're going to be tight because we've got this combination of outages and forecasts and things like that, and it looks like tight conditions. We'd rather know that 4 days out than we would 1 day out. So those are the three things that are going on in RAND Phase 3. This is an ongoing process working through the Resource Adequacy Subcommittee within our stakeholder process. But if you'll hear stuff about MISO, you'll hear that quite a bit. The next page just repeats what I think I've already said as far as those objectives. So wanted to just give you an update on RAN. We're in the middle of it. It's important because it's affecting things in real time and on the long-term planning horizon. And we'll continue to update you on where we're at with that.
We are now at 3 minutes to 3 o'clock. I know Commissioner Christman needs to leave. I just put in on the last page a really quick update on our distributed energy resources, as you've been hearing all day about the changing resource mix and what we're seeing in the future. One of the things that our stakeholders and the states, as being one of our stakeholders, has asked us to do is really start the conversation on distributed energy resources. Where do we see them? How do we see them coming into the wholesale markets? It's something FERC has asked us to do, but we haven't seen an order yet from FERC. So one of the things, like my update is, well, we still don't have an order from FERC, so we don't have direction that way as to what we're supposed to do with specifically with FERC. But what we are doing is spending a lot of time with our stakeholders and having conversations. And the conversations being, can we all speak the same language? What is a distributed energy resource? There isn't one definition of it. So what are we talking about? Let's get all of our stakeholders using the same language and talking about the same things. And then on top of that, what are the utilities seeing right now? Because distributed energy resources, by their nature, on their distribution system, that's not our area. And we want to learn from the distribution companies as to what they're seeing. And then how do we see the interface? Because this is what we're going to be dealing with, is the interface between the distribution, the distribution and transmission system, and on the impact on load of these resources. So we, starting in early 2019, we hosted, I think it was ended up being about 14 different workshops at three different levels, 100 being base, let's everybody talk the same language, here's what we're saying the definition is, 200, we brought in a lot of the utilities to talk about what they're seeing, and the 300 level was really focused discussions with distribution engineers, transmission engineers, talking to each other so there could be a conversation. Now we've taken a step back. We finished those in April timeframe. We've taken a step back. We're working really closely with the organization of MISO states as let's take all that information that we've heard and what is the next step? What are the next set of workshops? So we're working towards a September kind of debrief of what we've heard, what we're seeing on the what the utilities are seeing on the distribution side, and then what we see as the next issue. At the same time, internally, we have to be prepared for what is this changing load going to look like if it does come to fruition. So the engineers are really looking at what kind of issues we could see. This is a beginning of a long conversation, and without firm FERC direction, we're just going forward with those conversations, but there'll be continual updates as we keep coming up here in North Dakota. I would hope that anybody who wants to participate does participate in our workshops. There'll be lots more information about the next couple things that we're doing, but I just wanted to give you a quick update. And now I'm 10 seconds over.
I'm going to be the one that causes you to even be a few more. Do you feel like you have made progress on getting people to speak the same language? Because if so, I'd kind of like the dictionary. I hear people, and so I don't seem to follow.
Thank you for that question, because one of the things that our team internally is working on is we're going to put out, I passed out to you guys the MISO Forward report that came out earlier, and that is talking about the decentralization, demarginalization, and digitization as how we're seeing this world changing. We're putting together a similar document on distributed energy resources that's going to have a glossary attached to it, which is the joint understanding between the states, the stakeholders, and hopefully there'll be a common language in there. So I can give you a cheat sheet. Look for that in October.
Are you putting it on Wikipedia?
We'll put it on the MISO website, better than Wikipedia. So that's what we're seeing right now. Like I said, it was very, very quick, but it is very much the beginning of this, and you'll be hearing a lot more from me over the next few years on this.
Good. Okay. That was the gavel. Is that the gavel?
Sorry to raise out everybody. No. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for your time.
Very helpful.
Thank you.
All right.
See you at 3:30, right? 28 minutes.
All right.
I don't have anything else.
I don't either. Thank you. This was very helpful. I appreciate all the info. Sorry I missed the first 25 minutes of this afternoon. I trust I heard most of that at some point at an ISO meeting or OMS. So, no, I am.
And on that topic, though, thank you for your leadership around the transmission planning discussion that's had.
Sure.
It just recently happened at OMS. I know that was not an easy discussion to have.
No, well, we'll keep working on it. There's not a lot of unanimity any place in the world today, so why should this be any different? No, I think that there's, you know, a lot of complicated things going on, and to the extent that both of your organizations are working really hard on helping provide folks like us a lot of information, and you're smart people equipped with the tools they need to keep things going. Yep. A lot to keep track of. Right. Thank you for coming. I look forward to the next one.
Thank you.